Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Thank you very much, Carla. In the past 24 hours, Ukrainian troops have advanced by more than a kilometre towards Bakhmut in the east. They're seeking to dislodge occupying Russian forces from the symbolically important city. The advance comes as Ukraine prepares to mark 500 days since the Russian invasion. The first major conflict in Europe in over 30 years has lasted longer than many expected and resulted in millions of Ukrainians seeking refuge across the continent. And despite a much anticipated summer offensive, the military situation remains deadlocked, with Russia controlling about one-fifth of Ukraine, mostly in the east and in the south. Well, joining me to assess the situation 500 days in is Donika O'Bakon, who's Professor of Politics at DCU. Good morning, Donika, and thank you for joining us again on the programme.
Good morning, Claire.
Now, we're approaching this milestone of 500 days. Is it possible to assess whether or not we're closer to the end of this war than to the beginning?
Well, it is, as you suggest, a grim milestone. It is also impossible to say whether we're closer to the end than we were, but it's a very different war from the one that Vladimir Putin thought he was going to launch almost 500 days ago. He thought it would be over in a couple of days, maximum 2 weeks. And in fact, 16 months later, he was in front of his nation again on TV saying that Russia itself was in danger, a situation that Russians never thought they were going to be in following the invasion of Ukraine. And it's been a very different 500 days for Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky. You might remember again at the beginning of the war, you know, he was there on the streets of Kyiv reassuring his people. He was there with his mobile phone and his cabinet saying, "We haven't left you. We're still in Kyiv." And now he's where is he today? He's in Prague. He was in Sofia yesterday. He's going to Turkey soon. He's on a very different type of mission now, reassuring his people that he has this diplomatic support abroad, because he knows that the military offensive and the diplomatic offensive run hand in hand, because Ukraine very much depends on the support of its allies. And as you say, this counteroffensive, it's moving slowly forward. And as was said today in the Czech Republic by President Pavel, it has to work for Ukraine this summer, because there won't be another offensive before the end of the year.
Talk to me a little bit more about that, because it was long promised. It has so far, though, appeared certainly to be sporadic and even sluggish. Is that the case on the ground, Donika?
Well, I mean, in a situation of a counteroffensive, the defender always has the advantage. They are entrenched and you have to take the entrenched positions. That's always been the case. And it's a very long front line of over 1,000 kilometres. So I still think, and many people who are observing the counteroffensive have observed, that it's still very much at a probing level. And Volodymyr Zelensky said at his press conference with President Pavel that, you know, they are moving only forward, not backwards like the Russians. So he sees this as a positive thing. And he's also said that it's not a movie, you know, it's not there to meet the expectations of others, and they're not going to jeopardize unnecessarily Ukrainian lives. This is a big difference in the way that the war has been fought by the two armies. You know, the Wagner group, which was particularly strong in fighting in Bakhmut, I mean, they were essentially using conscripted people that they'd emptied the prisons, more or less. They had no sense of the value of the lives they were throwing into battle. Ukrainians, you know, these are regular people who have been, you know, largely volunteers, mobilized. They're not going to just throw them in to a situation unless they're absolutely convinced that they're going to gain territory and liberate the people living there as a result.
Mm-hmm. And when people saw that mutiny happen by members of the Wagner mercenary group, led of course by Yevgeny Prigozhin, nobody knows where he is. He was supposed to be in Belarus. Now they're saying that he's in Russia and he's walking around freely. What do you think that has said about Vladimir Putin and his status and how powerful he now is?
Well, it's very much weakened his brand, you might say, as an authoritarian leader. And indeed, every day that Prigozhin lives and thrives is in a way a mockery of kind of the dictatorship mold that, you know, Vladimir Putin has spent almost a quarter century putting together. I mean, the Kremlin implausibly said yesterday that they're not keeping a track of where Prigozhin is. I mean, this is remarkable considering that only 2 weeks ago, less than 2 weeks ago, he was being accused by Vladimir Putin on television as being a traitor responsible for the biggest threat to Russian sovereignty since the overthrow of the Tsar in 1917. So there was a press conference yesterday in Belarus. The president President Lukashenko confirmed that Prigozhin is not there, that he's probably in St. Petersburg. What's interesting is that there was a raid, a very publicized raid on his palace in St. Petersburg. There's no other way to describe it. And they were showing leaked material that can only be, of course, provided by the Russian FSB, of gold bars, of lots of money, of a plush residence. It seems they might be softening up the public, for some, other charges, perhaps of corruption or something like that. But it's hard to believe that the Kremlin isn't keeping a very close tab on Yevgeny Prigozhin.
Mm. You would have seen those rather hilarious pictures of Prigozhin in his various disguises. Did you see those, Danica?
I did. And but I think, that of course, attracted some hilarity in some quarters. But I think there's a more serious issue really about, his whereabouts, and also what it means for the Russian military. There are several senior members of the Russian military that haven't been seen now in since the rebellion 2 weeks ago. And there's talk of a purge within the Russian military. There's also the question of where Belarus stands in all of this. I mean, again, this press conference was very interesting yesterday because it has escaped the notice of many that, Russia is moving tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus. And there's a question of whether Lukashenko will have any role in whether those nuclear weapons are used, those tactical nuclear weapons. And because Belarus is very much, it has ceded sovereignty essentially to Russia since 2020 when Putin came to Lukashenko's rescue. And of course, the invasion of Kyiv last year was launched from Belarus. So this is in a way far more serious, this kind of alliance between Putin and Lukashenko.
Yeah, and do you think that's where the alliance really lies? Or given the fact that Prigozhin still seems to be a free threat to Russia and to Putin, that perhaps there could be an alliance between Lukashenko and Prigozhin?
I think it's very unlikely that there's an alliance between Lukashenko and Prigozhin simply because Lukashenko has very much tied himself to Putin, his fate to Putin. And they've both been in power for, more or less the quarter century mark. So they have formed this, and they meet each other almost every month. So they have formed a bond, if you might say that, of some kind. So I don't think it's plausible that Prigozhin is in alliance with Lukashenko.
Mm-hmm. And those pictures that they released of Prigozhin wearing wigs and beards and hats and glasses, was that really an attempt to say to people, if you see him, he may not look like he does in his social media videos? Is that where they're at in terms of knowing where he is?
It's difficult to know the motivation of this. As I said, it seems to be softening the public for something, by releasing this confidential information about Prigozhin. But at the same time, Putin has allowed Prigozhin to be at liberty, so it seems, and has said publicly that they had the right to move to Belarus, he and the Wagner Group. But Lukashenko said yesterday that they haven't moved to Belarus. So we're left in this quandary of where they are, what their status is. And of course, they play a major role in propping up, regional autocrats in Africa. It's not known where that will stand. And of course, as we approach again this milestone, the war in Ukraine continues, but it seems without Wagner. There's been some horrendous attacks in the last couple of days. Lviv, of course, was attacked only yesterday, the centre of Lviv. And Lviv is as far away from the front line in Ukraine as Istanbul is. So this has no military relevance at all. This is about, terrorizing Ukrainians because they are Ukrainians. They are considered an enemy people.
So as we come up to this milestone, as you say, Danica, are there any viable routes to peace now on the table?
Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a landing spot for negotiations. I mean, people who talk of something like peace now are unable to come up with any detail about why Vladimir Putin will hand over the territory that he seized by force as a result of negotiations. Everything about his past and his present, and indeed his rhetoric, if you take him at his word, is all about retaining the territory, which he claims is Russian. Remember, back in September, he claimed that four regions, in addition to Crimea, were Russian territory, even though Russia still to this day doesn't hold any of those four territories in perpetuity. But what we learned, I think, from the Prigozhin rebellion is that when Putin is pushed by military force, he does show ingenuity. He does back down. I mean, because he constantly threatens escalation if his kind of imaginary red lines are crossed. But I think he's like any bully. He exploits weaknesses where he perceives them, but then he's intimidated by strength. And I think there are vital lessons, therefore, to be learned from what we saw happen in the Prigozhin rebellion, that when needs must, he can and does back down. He adapts his narrative. He has a pliant state media. He has a pliant citizenry who can digest a different story. So I think that the lesson is that power in Russia matters much more to Putin than victory in Ukraine, and that the quicker he's convinced that war in Ukraine weakens his reign, the faster the war will end.
All right, Donika, thank you very much. 500 days of the war in Ukraine. That's Professor Donika Bakhon from the School of Law and Government at DCU.